Every 15 Seconds by G.K. Chesterfield. Chapter 1. Where Did It Go Wrong? It was love at first sight. At least for me it was. I remember the first time I saw him. I was 16 years old and still at high school. He was 20 and in his second year at college. It was at a place we used to go to on weekends, a club called The Lowdown. They used to turn the music up high and the lights way down low. I had gone there with two friends of mine, Cheryl and Darlene. They were dancing with each other, so I was sitting at the table all on my own. He was standing at the bar with a group of his friends. They were laughing and joking about something, but he wasn't. He was just standing there with a little half-smile on his face, and he was looking straight at me. He was tall, dark, handsome, and dressed in black from head to toe. I smiled back at him. Then, for a moment, it occurred to me that maybe he was smiling at somebody sitting behind me. I remember I felt foolish then and embarrassed. I lowered my eyes quickly. When I looked up again, he was standing right there in front of me. "My name's Roy," he said. "What's yours?" "Karen," I said, my heart pounding. "You know something, Karen?" he said. "You're the best-looking girl in here. You want to dance?" And that was how it started, our life together, our love. Roy had an old beat-up Ford in those days. He used to pick me up in front of my house and we'd drive down to the ocean. When I think back on those early days, that's what I remember best, the two of us strolling along the beach at sunset, hand in hand, our whole lives in front of us. I remember him telling me one evening, "You belong to me now, Karen, and you'd better not forget it. Don't you ever even look at another man." He was possessive and jealous, and I liked that about him. It showed that he cared, that he really loved me. That's what you think love is when you're 16 years old, if you're as stupid as I was. We got married 2 years later, in 1992. Roy had graduated by then and found a job selling insurance. The only problem was that the job was in Sunnyvale, so we had to move away from Oakland, where I grew up. That made it difficult for me to see my family or friends anymore, but the truth is I didn't really worry too much about that then. Roy's parents lent us some money so we could make a down payment on a cute little two-bedroom house on Kimberley Drive. The day we moved into our new home, Roy picked me up in his arms and carried me over the threshold, a real gentleman. We had our ups and downs, of course, as all young couples do, but in spite of everything, our first year in Sunnyvale was probably the happiest year of my life. Even though Roy was out at work all day and I was in the house, we had a common purpose. He was the breadwinner and I was the homemaker, and we were both working for the same thing, our future together, and the family we were going to raise. We were really close. Maybe we didn't have all the material things we wanted, but we had each other, and that was more than enough. Roy was everything for me, everything I needed, everything I lived for. So where did it all go wrong? That's the question I keep asking myself in one form or another. I know a lot of things now that I didn't know then. I've been in the penitentiary for 8 years, and believe me, I've learned a lot of things the hard way. But even so, from the moment they wake me up in the morning until the moment they switch out the lights at night, and often all night through, I turn that question over and over in my mind. Where did it all go wrong? How could it have happened? What mistake did I make? Why did he change? And no matter what answers I find, I always come back to the same scene. It's the afternoon of Friday, November the 22nd, 1996. I'm standing in the kitchen doorway. Roy is lying on his side on the kitchen floor. "Now look what you've done," he's whispering. "What did you do that for?" But he has difficulty saying the words because blood is coming out of his mouth and he's choking on it. I didn't mean to, I'm saying over and over. I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. In the family room, a uniformed police officer is speaking on the phone. I need an ambulance, quick. 17 Kimberley Drive. Yeah, okay, right. It looks like attempted homicide. Yeah, I'll wait. Then, leafing through Roy's wallet, the victim's name is Roy Rosewell, male, Caucasian, 26 years old. Yeah, that's right. The suspect is with me now. Her name is Karen Rosewell. Roy died before the paramedics arrived. Chapter 2. How did it start? I remember one evening Roy brought a colleague from work home for dinner, a guy called Bill Bunsey. Roy hadn't warned me about it, so I had only prepared food for the two of us as usual. "That's no problem, honey," Roy said. "Give Bill yours and fix yourself a sandwich." So that's what I did. Bill Bunsey had brought a bottle of wine with him and a bottle of whiskey. Long after the meal had finished, the two of them remained at the table smoking and drinking and talking. When I had done the dishes and cleaned everything away, I patted myself on the stomach and said, "I'm really tired, you guys. You don't mind if we two go to bed early, do you?" I said we because I was pregnant with Louise at the time. "I mind," Roy said. "Sit down and join in the conversation. Show my guest a little respect." I was so astonished by the harshness of his tone, a tone I had never heard him use before, that I couldn't think of a single thing to say. I sat down with them at the table, deeply embarrassed. That year there was a scandal about President Clinton having affairs with a lot of women when he was governor of Arkansas. Roy and Bill Bunsey talked about that, making a lot of smutty jokes. I didn't think their jokes were funny, but I lowered my eyes and smiled politely. Finally, around 2 in the morning, Bill Bunsey said, "My goodness, is that the time? I've got to go, folks. I want to thank both of you for a wonderful evening." Then, putting his arm around my shoulders and pulling me against his chest, he said, "Especially our lovely hostess." And with that, he kissed me on the cheek. It was a wet, drunken kiss which seemed to last forever. Struggling to get free, I caught a glimpse of Roy glaring at me. When Bunsey had gone, Roy was furious. He strode up and down the room, kicking the furniture. I had never seen him like that before. In the centre of the room there was a glass-topped coffee table with a vase of flowers on it. He picked up the vase and smashed it down on top of the table, breaking both into hundreds of pieces. "Do you think I didn't see you?" he screamed. "Do you think I'm blind?" "What did I do?" I asked him. "What did I do?" "You were giving him the eye all evening, you bitch, right under my nose, here in my own home, making me look like a fool." "But that's crazy," I said. I didn't get the chance to say anything else, because at that moment he punched me in the face. Swearing and shouting insults, he pushed me against the wall and punched me again. I slid to the floor. "Don't you dare deny it," he yelled. "Don't you dare deny it." And he started kicking me. "Roy, the baby," I cried. "The baby. Think about the baby." But he was mad with rage and he kept on kicking me. I put my arms around my head and rolled my body into a ball, trying to protect myself and the baby. After a while, I didn't feel the blows anymore. I had lost consciousness. When I came to an hour or so later, Roy was kneeling beside me. He had a wet cloth in his hand and he was dabbing it gently against my face. Every part of my body hurt. "I'm sorry, honey," he was saying. "I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. I don't know what happened. You've got to believe me, Karen. I didn't mean it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't tell you how sorry I am." He was crying. "I've got a lot of problems at the office at the moment," he said. "I'm under a lot of pressure. I don't know what came over me tonight. I guess it was the booze. I shouldn't touch that stuff. Forgive me, Karen. Please say you forgive me. I swear nothing like this is ever going to happen again." That night we lay in each other's arms, like the children in the fairy tale, lost in the middle of the darkest forest in the world. "Nothing like that is ever going to happen again," Roy sobbed over and over again. "You've got to believe me, Karen. You've got to believe me." I believed him. Then, 3 weeks later, on our first wedding anniversary, it happened again. He had taken me out to an expensive restaurant to celebrate, a thing we couldn't afford to do very often. That night we drank champagne. I was really happy. I thought that what had happened was some kind of freak occurrence, a thing that happened to other couples, but should never have happened to us. It was all some big mistake. In the middle of the meal, however, Roy suddenly became very silent. He drove home in a kind of cold fury, refusing to speak. But as soon as we got inside the house, he started. "You bitch, you slut, you whore. You think I didn't see you smiling at that waiter? You think I'm blind? You think I'm stupid?" Then the punching, the kicking, the screams. Chapter 3. Why did I stay? That time, too, he apologised, wept, begged for forgiveness, swore it would never happen again. In the weeks that followed, he was as gentle as a lamb, as sweet as an angel. He brought me flowers. He called me during the day to ask me how I was, how the baby was. He helped me with the housework, all things he had never done before. After Louise was born, nothing happened for about 6 months. Life seemed to return to the way it was before. Roy out at work all day, me at home looking after the baby and trying to make things nice. I never told anybody about what had happened. I was too ashamed. That may sound strange, but we are all brought up with romantic notions about love and marriage. A happy marriage is supposed to be the end of the story, the reward for being in love, the prize. If things go wrong, you can't help blaming yourself. You think, it must be because of something I did. I must have done something wrong. So in some way I didn't fully understand, I felt ashamed of myself. But also I was ashamed for Roy. I didn't want people to know that he wasn't always the sweet, charming, considerate husband that he appeared to be. I loved him. I didn't want people to think badly of him. And of course, all the time you hope and pray that it's never going to happen again. You want to believe that so much that in the end you do believe it. You convince yourself that the bad times are behind you, that things are going to be okay from now on. Or rather, you almost convince yourself. Because now, somewhere at the back of your mind, there's always that little nagging doubt, that little spark of fear waiting to burst into flames again. And then one day it does. That evening, Roy came back from work later than usual. I could see right away that something was wrong, and I could smell the whiskey on his breath. "What's the matter, dear?" I asked. "Did you have a bad day at the office?" He didn't answer my question. Instead, he said, "Shut up and get my dinner, you stupid bitch." I went to the kitchen and got his dinner from the oven. I was trembling with fear as I put the plate on the table. I knew what was coming next, and I knew I was powerless to stop it. "Quit looking at me like that," he yelled. I said, "Quit looking at me like that." He picked up the plate and threw it at me. I moved my head just in time, and the plate smashed against the wall, splashing food everywhere. "Now look what you made me do," he screamed, his eyes wild with fury. He rose from the table and seized me by the neck. "I'll kill you, you bitch. I'll kill you." He tightened his fingers around my throat, squeezing tighter and tighter. I must have fainted then, because a few minutes later I realised we were in the kitchen. Now he was splashing water against my face, but there was nothing gentle about the way he was doing it. "Wake up, you ugly bitch," he was yelling. "Wake up and beg for your worthless life." He had a gun in his hand, and he kept thrusting it into my face. I had never seen him with a gun before. Terrified, I begged him not to kill me. "For our child's sake," I pleaded, "for the baby's sake." He hit me in the face with the gun. I could taste the blood and tears flowing into my mouth. He punched and kicked me again and again. Finally, he said, "You're not worth killing. You're not worth the price of a bullet." Then he staggered off to bed. That night, I should have grabbed Louise out of her cot and run as far away as my legs could carry us. But where to? And what with? I didn't know anybody in Sunnyvale. I had never learned how to drive. I didn't have any money. Roy had always given me a housekeeping allowance, but that was only a few dollars. I was trapped, a prisoner in my own home. The next day, I put on dark glasses and a headscarf. It was a beautiful, sunny day, but I put on a raincoat too and pulled the collar up around my face. I went to see the doctor. I didn't tell him all the details, of course. I was too ashamed and scared to do that. I just told him that Roy and I had had a row. He listened patiently to my story, then said, "Your husband's probably under a lot of stress at work at the moment. Maybe he needs a holiday. You look a little tense yourself, Mrs. Rosewell. Maybe that irritates him. You know how these things are. You've got to try and take it easy a little. I'll give you some pills to help you relax." Before I left his office, I made him promise me that he wouldn't tell Roy about our conversation. "If he knew I was here, he'd go crazy," I said. "Don't worry, Mrs. Rosewell," the doctor said. "My lips are sealed." When I got home, I called my mother. I didn't tell her all the details either. She said, "Darling, that's just the way things are between men and women. That's the way they've always been, and that's the way they're always going to be. Just try not to provoke him. That's the best advice I can give you, sweetheart. Let him have his way. If you stand up to him, it'll only make things worse. All couples go through bad spells, and that's what's happening to you now. But everything will work out in the end. You'll see, you'll see." The doctor called Roy that evening. Chapter 4. What could I do? After that, the beatings became more frequent. I never knew when he was suddenly going to lose his temper and fly into a rage. Often it came out of nowhere. For no reason I could see, he would start shaking his fist in my face. He would slap my face for making some banal remark. If he imagined that I was thinking the wrong thoughts, he would pick up the nearest object, a glass, an ashtray, anything, and hurl it at me. And that would only be the beginning. If he had a bad day at the office, I got a beating. If he had a good day at the office, I got a beating. If he was drunk, if he was sober, the result was the same. If I spoke to him, if I was silent, if I agreed with him, if I disagreed, if I looked at him, if I lowered my eyes, there was no logic to it. It was as if some capricious demon lived in him. I can't describe my state of mind during those years. After a beating, you become hysterical. Your whole body shakes uncontrollably, and you can't stop crying. It's a horrible feeling. But even worse is the permanent tension you live in, every minute of the day, every day of the year, as though your life were happening in the middle of a minefield where every step could be your last. I thought that maybe things might change at least a little when my son Scott was born. That was in September 1994. Roy had always said that he had no use for a daughter. He had criticised me after Louise's birth, saying things like, "You're not even able to give me a son." But Scott's birth didn't make any difference. For months before and after it, insulting me was Roy's favourite leisure activity. "Look at yourself in the mirror," he would say. "You're just getting uglier and uglier. When are you going to take some exercise? When are you going to lose some weight? Other men have normal-looking wives. Look what I've got. Jesus, what man in his right mind would want a woman like you? You're the biggest mistake I ever made, that's for sure. You should get down on your knees and thank me for keeping you. You should be begging me right now to let you stay." The worst thing was that I was beginning to believe him. I was beginning to think that maybe I was as worthless as he kept telling me I was. I could see no way out of it, nor any possible end to it. If I didn't have two young children who'd need me, I thought, I'd kill myself. 2 years passed like that. 2 years of insults, beatings, solitude, terror. Then something happened. Something I hadn't expected at all. Roy disappeared. One evening, at the end of October 1996, he didn't come back from work. He didn't call, of course. He just didn't come home. The next day, he didn't come home either, or the day after that. I didn't know what to do. Should I call his office? Should I call the police? Roy had forbidden me to use the phone without his permission. I knew what would happen if I disobeyed him and he found out. 3 weeks passed without any news from him. I had to know what had happened to him, so I called his office. "I'd like to speak to Mr. Rosewell," I said. "This is his wife speaking." "I thought he was at home," an angry voice said. "He's supposed to be at home in bed, too sick to come to work." I knew then that I had made a serious mistake. The next day was Friday, November the 22nd. That afternoon I was in the kitchen doing the ironing. Scott was having a nap in the bedroom, and Louise was with me, playing on the floor with her dolls. It was the quietest, most normal afternoon any of us had enjoyed in years. That was the moment Roy chose to come back. I looked up from my ironing, and he was standing there in the doorway, with his hands on his hips glaring at me. His jacket was open, so the first thing I saw was the gun stuck in his waistband. It was black and ugly, like a toad. "You bitch," he screamed. "I lost my job because of you." He moved towards me quickly. "I'm going to teach you a lesson you won't forget." "No, Roy, please," I begged. "I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to." Louise started crying. Roy grabbed me by the hair with one hand and the hot iron with the other. "I'm going to fix your ugly face once and for all," he said, pulling my head towards the iron. I didn't think. In terror, I seized the gun from his waistband and pulled the trigger. Roy dropped the iron and staggered backwards. I shot him again, and again and again and again and again. Even when the gun was empty, I continued to pull the trigger. Roy was lying on his side on the floor. He was still alive. He was saying, "Now look what you've done. What did you do that for?" I put the gun down on the kitchen table. I carried Louise into the family room and told her to be good. Then I went back into the kitchen and began to tidy up the mess. I was in shock, of course. I picked up the iron from the floor and put it in the closet. I collected the clothes I had ironed and carried them to the bedroom and put them in the wardrobe. I folded the ironing board and put it away too. A little while later, the doorbell rang. It was a uniformed police officer. "We got a call from one of your neighbours, ma'am," he said. "She said she heard gunshots coming from this house." A little after that, the policeman was using our phone to call for assistance. "I need an ambulance, quick," he was saying. 17 Kimberley Drive. "Yeah. Okay, right. It looks like attempted homicide. Yeah. I'll wait. The victim's name is Roy Rosewell." That was when I started laughing. I couldn't stop. Chapter 5. Who are the victims? Nobody believed me. I told them it was self-defence. I told them about the iron. "Mrs. Rosewell," the prosecutor asked, "do you expect the jury to believe that after shooting your husband 6 times, you casually decided to do a little housework and that you tidied all the ironing things away?" He waited a few seconds, then added, "The iron was broken, Mrs. Rosewell. It didn't work. Do you expect the jury to believe that you were ironing your husband's shirts with a broken iron?" I suppose the iron must have broken when it fell. Witness after witness was called to speak about Roy. They all said what a kind, loving husband they knew him to be. They said that they had frequently heard him calling me from the office and saying kind, loving things to me. I couldn't believe my ears. I don't know who the woman was that he was calling, but it certainly wasn't me. The only witness I recognised was Bill Bunsey. He said, "Roy told me that he was worried about his wife being on her own all day. He told me that he bought the gun for her so that she could protect herself if necessary." It turned out that Roy had a girlfriend. Her name was Virginia Lewis. It was with her that Roy had spent the last 3 weeks of his life. When she was called as a witness, she said, "Roy was the sweetest, gentlest human being I have ever known. He told me that his wife never stopped nagging him. She made his existence a living hell." The doctor was called as a witness. He remembered only vaguely that I had come to see him, but he remembered clearly the telephone conversation that he had had with Roy. I told Mr. Rosewell about his wife's fears. He explained to me that she had been under a lot of stress recently and that he was going to take good care of her. He appeared to me to be a calm, considerate, and perfectly reasonable man. I told them about the 4 years of abuse I had suffered. Nobody believed me. How could they? Admit it, Mrs. Rosewell, the prosecutor said. Somehow you found out that your husband was having an affair with Miss Lewis. You became insanely jealous and decided to kill him with the gun he had given you for your protection. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. At the end of the trial, the judge said, Karen Madeline Rosewell, you have been found guilty of murder in the first degree. You are a cold-blooded, calculating killer. I am sentencing you to life imprisonment in the state penitentiary at Corona without the possibility of parole. That was 8 years ago. Since then, I have had plenty of time to consider my mistakes. I know that I am paying a high price for them. I will never leave this place alive, and I will never see my beautiful children again. What have I learned? I have learned that when violence starts, you have to speak out. You have to scream it from the rooftops. I have learned that there is a war going on, a hidden war, a war no one wants to talk about. According to the FBI, in this so-called civilized country of ours, a woman is battered every 15 seconds. According to the American Medical Association, one woman in four will be the victim of domestic violence in her lifetime. And it's not only here, not only in America. It's the same in England, in France, in Germany, in Japan, in all the civilized and uncivilized countries. There are hundreds of millions of victims, women slapped, punched, kicked, choked, beaten, imprisoned, terrorized, raped, maimed, murdered, destroyed. We have to ask ourselves, why is that? It's too late for me. It doesn't have to be too late for others.